Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 192. It's Monday, January 2nd. Happy New Year. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, I want to start off with a quick update on COVID-19. Looks like we got a new subvariant raging around. The XBB.1.5 subvariant has skyrocketed in the last month, and we expect that the crest of this wave is still to come to Ohio from the northeast. COVID hospitalizations are rising rapidly, and those hospitalizations are surpassing the peak that we saw in the summer amid the quick rollout of new Omicron variants. And in another COVID-19 roundup, from your local epidemiologist, Caitlin Jadalina, COVID in China, the U.S., and everything in between. First up, China, a humanitarian disaster. As expected, the COVID-19 situation in China is out of hand. In an interesting turn of events, China went from a zero COVID policy to a let-it-rip policy by dropping all mitigation measures without fully vaccinating the highest risk or strengthening their healthcare system. Egregiously, they stopped reporting cases, hospitalizations, and deaths, too. That looks good for them on paper, but when we rely on Epidemiology 101, that is common sense, and anecdotal reports, which are plentiful, the situation in China is beyond grim. Officials estimate between 5 and 10,000 people are dying each day. At the U.S. peak, we lost 3,800 people per day, but of course the U.S. only has about a quarter of the population, as China does. Epidemiologists expect the death toll to rise in China in the coming months, leading to 500,000 to 1 million cumulative deaths in over a few months. A humanitarian disaster. Just like cases and deaths, though, China is not reporting genomic data. In other words, we don't know if and how the virus is changing and what it may or may not mean to the international community. So with that much virus raging around, of course, you have more chances of variants developing. So we'll be watching that closely, but we're largely blind because there isn't a lot of genomic surveillance that's being, if it's being done in China, it's not being shared transparently with the international community. And then, of course, back to the U.S., a homegrown problem. Regardless of the China situation, current variants in the U.S. are likely more problematic, at least in the short term. Specifically, we have a new subvariant on the horizon, XBB.1.5. This is an offshoot of BA.2, which is different from the subvariant currently circulating, BQ.1.1, which was an offshoot of BA.5. Ugh, alphabet soup. Both lab and epidemiological data show XBB.1.5 may be a cause for concern. In the real world, and particularly in New York, cases are exponentially increasing. Currently, XBB.1.5 has a 120% weekly growth advantage, which equates to, on average, one infected person infecting two others. This rate is higher than we've seen with any other subvariant this year, given our immunity wall. So, as expected, we see a clear uptick in northeast wastewater. This is unwelcome given that admissions for people over age 70, for example, are the third highest since the pandemic began. This doesn't reflect the new variant or impact of holidays yet either. In the lab, XBB.1.5 is presenting a more confusing picture. It has a similar ability to escape our immunity as other subvariants. Because of this, we wouldn't think it would cause a massive wave compared to what is circulating right now. XBB 1.5 does have higher ACE2 binding affinity. That is, it allows it to latch onto our cells better. It's more sticky. But that wouldn't necessarily cause it to be more transmissible. So something else may be going on. Perhaps another part of the virus may have changed that influences transmission. We need to look into this more. And the bottom line, we should be very concerned for the people of China, and it is possible that a variant of concern will arise from that disaster. But the U.S. already has a problem of its own. I was hoping for a quieter 2023. There may still be a chance, but these are not welcome developments going into the new year. And an update to an ongoing story in Ohio, this from Medical Express. Measles outbreak in Ohio infects 82 kids, most of them unvaccinated. A measles outbreak in central Ohio has now infected at least 82 children. Most of those impacted by the outbreak have been under the age of 5, state officials report. Since details of the first measles cases were announced last month, in November, by Columbus Public Health, 32 children have been hospitalized. About 90% of unvaccinated people exposed to measles will become infected, Columbus health officials warned. About 20% of those wind up hospitalized with the virus. Measles symptoms include a high fever, cough, runny nose, and watery eyes about a week or two after an exposure, according to the CDC. These symptoms are typically followed by a rash about 3 to 5 days later. The Ohio outbreak comprises most of the 2022 measles cases in the entire United States, with numbers now greater than reported cases in 2020 and 2021 combined. Well, as far as measles go, Ohio is number one. And perhaps a little bit better news. This from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy from the University of Minnesota. Experts challenge the narrative for this season's flu activity. Basically saying it may not be as bad as some people had feared. But the bad news first, healthcare crisis compounding infections. Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy, said the main story of this year's respiratory illness season is that it's taking place in a broken U.S. healthcare system defined by fewer pediatric hospitals and emergency rooms, provider burnout, and supply chain shortages. 30% of beds in the U.S. hospitals are occupied by long-term care or step-down patients, for which beds are not available outside of the hospital, he said. ERs act as a mental health holding area, and we are well short of all staff that should be required. The healthcare system is broken. Until we fix it, relatively minor increases in cases will be challenging. So I want to emphasize that 30% of U.S. hospitals are occupied by long-term care or step-down patients. These are people that should be transferred to other facilities, but they cannot be, so they're stuck in the hospital. Yeah, big problem. And then, of course, ERs acting as mental health holding areas, particularly for young people, has been true for a long time. It's a continuing problem. Okay, for a little bit perhaps better news, not an outlier season. He noted that this year's season began notably early, with surveillance showing a rapid uptake in flu activity in weeks 40 and 42 of the year, one of the earlier flu seasons recorded in the past 20 to 30 years. But an earlier flu season does not necessarily mean more cases overall, nor does it eliminate the chance of having a moderate season. Only 7% of nursing homes have had a single case of flu as of last week, Osterholm said. It does feel like it's bad because hospitals are so understaffed, but that does not represent an outlier season. Osterholm said it's impossible to predict exactly what will happen this flu season. There could be a second peak in January or February, but for now, he believes the United States has seen an early flu season that's on the decline. And unless there's a second peak, he noted, U.S. flu hospitalizations are on track to be average for this year's season. Okay, well, I want to do a few stories here on women's health. First one up from Medical Express. Where do reproductive age women receive preventive health care? While preventive health care is usually associated with primary care providers, a majority of office visits for preventive services among reproductive age women happened with obstetrician gynecologists, OB-GYNs, a University of Massachusetts Amherst study shows. Even among reproductive age women with chronic health conditions, over 40% of preventive care visits were with OB-GYNs. The study's findings also reveal that certain recommended services rarely occurred in any setting. For example, screening for depression happened in only 6% of primary care visits and just under 4% of visits with OB-GYNs. Preventive care is important for helping people optimize their wellness. There have been various policy measures over the years to try to increase people's use of preventive care, including a provision in the Affordable Care Act, which required that certain preventive services be covered at no cost to patients for that visit or that service. Typically, these initiatives are aimed at primary care, which doesn't necessarily account for the fact that, in fact, reproductive age women are largely seeing OB-GYNs for preventive care. The patterns were similar in the overall reproductive female patient population, and when the sample was limited to reproductive age women with chronic conditions, including depression, diabetes, asthma, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol, some 30% of visits with generalist physicians included lipid testing for cholesterol levels, compared to a, quote, astonishingly low 2.8% of visits with OB-GYNs. On the flip side, some reproductive-related services may be underprovided in primary care visits. We can just see that there are pretty big differences across physician specialty, including for women with chronic conditions. So this just gets sort of the complications that women that are seeing OB-GYNs a lot are splitting a lot of their care with primary care providers, and also that with the attack on reproductive health services and on women is that it, we know that that decreases overall health care for women, because women get a lot of their, a wide variety of health care from OB-GYNs and other reproductive health services. And getting to how tough that is on women, this from MedPage Today. Abortion access tied to suicide rates among young women. Restrictions on access to reproductive care were associated with suicide rates among women of reproductive age, researchers found. In a longitudinal ecological study using state-based data from 1974 to 2016, enforcement of targeted regulation of abortion providers, TRAP laws, was associated with higher suicide rates among reproductive women, but not among women of post-reproductive age, according to Ran Barzilay of the University of Pennsylvania. Nor was enforcement of TRAP laws associated with deaths due to motor vehicle crashes, they reported in JAMA Psychiatry. Taken together, the results suggest that the association between restricting access to abortion and suicide rates is specific to the women who are most affected by this restriction, which are young women. Barzilay said their study can inform, number one, clinicians working with young women to be aware that this is a macro-level suicide risk factor in this population, and number two, that it informs policymakers as they allocate resources for suicide prevention, and number three, that it informs the ethical, divisive debate regarding access to abortion. Okay, well, next up, some better news for pregnant workers and new moms. This from Axios. Senate passes milestone protections for pregnant workers and new mothers. It's about time. The Pregnant Workers Fairness Act and the Pump for Nursing Mothers Act passed the Senate with bipartisan support. Why it matters? It's a major milestone for women's workplace civil rights. Advocates have pushed for protections for pregnant workers for over a decade, arguing that thousands of women lose their jobs each year, either fired or placed on unpaid leave, because employers are under no obligation to offer pregnant workers reasonable accommodations. That would include things like extra bathroom breaks, the ability to sit while working in a cash register, or restrictions on how much weight they can lift. Employers can no longer treat pregnant workers like they're expendable once they find out they're expecting a child or need a modest accommodation to prevent serious health complications, said Dina Bakst, co-founder of A Better Balance, an advocacy group that has led efforts for the past decade to pass the bill. And next up from The Hill, an article getting at the advantages of Medicaid expansion. Medicaid expansion linked with improved cancer survival in young adults. Cancer is the fourth leading cause of death among young adults in America. Young adults are also more likely to lack health insurance. New data showing expanding Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act was associated with significant benefits in two-year cancer survival outcomes among young adults. The two-year survival benefit was most pronounced among individuals who identify as Hispanic or Black and those with breast cancer or stage 4 cancers. Writing in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, researchers explained how previous studies linked Medicaid expansion with improved insurance coverage and early cancer diagnosis among young adults. Young adults typically have the highest uninsured rates compared with other age groups. Okay, well, next up, I have a really interesting story from Stat News that covers one of the pillars of health, sleep, getting adequate rest, also is a great exposition on the social determinants that help form our health. And one of those it addresses specifically, which is racism. This from Stat News. Racism leads to troubled sleep, and it's putting Black Americans' heart health at risk. Lots of people struggle to get enough sleep, and the responsibility for fixing the problem tends to fall on the individual. Experts offer advice like reducing screen time, exercising more, or just going to bed earlier in the evening. But many restless nights can't be solved with blackout curtains, earplugs, or other typical suggestions. On average, Black adults in the U.S. get poorer sleep than white adults, often for reasons outside of their control. A growing number of experts argue that in order to address such racial disparities, health professionals need to start discussing sleep within the complex tapestry of a person's life and surroundings. A large proportion of disparities in sleep are really due to social and environmental factors, such as noise pollution, said Mercedes Carnathan, vice chair of preventive medicine at Northwestern University School of Medicine, and an expert on racial disparities in cardiovascular disease. The implications of these sleep disparities are far-reaching. The medical world has known for decades that habitually poor sleep increases the risk for heart disease. If more people regularly got the recommended 7 to 9 hours of restful sleep, experts assert, the incidence of heart disease, the most frequent cause of death in the U.S., could fall substantially. Earlier this year, the American Heart Association went so far as to add getting a good night's sleep to its central recommendations for improving cardiovascular health. Consistently better sleep for all, in turn, could help narrow the existing racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic disparities in cardiometabolic diseases, according to Lauren Hale, a professor of preventive medicine and expert in sleep behavior at Stony Brook Medicine. About 229 of every 100,000 Black Americans died from heart disease in 2020, compared to 170 deaths per 100,000 white Americans. That's 229 versus 170. Some researchers have estimated that at least half of the racial disparities in cardiometabolic disease risk can be traced back to differences in the sleep patterns of Black and white Americans. Sleep hygiene recommendations do not address underlying structural causes of disparities, Hale said. The real challenge is translating the science of what we know about sleep and its disparities into scalable, sustainable interventions. Sleep is notoriously challenging to study, especially as it happens under messy, real-world circumstances outside of the controlled research laboratory. For starters, sleep is so multidimensional, said Kristen Knutson, an associate professor of sleep medicine and epidemiology at Northwestern School of Medicine. From a health perspective, what matters is not just how long a person sleeps, but also factors like the quality of their sleep and when they sleep. About one-third of adults in the U.S. report getting fewer than 7 hours of sleep per night, according to the CDC, and that likely misses a substantial portion of people who awake up through the night, even if they're not aware of it. Despite the prevalence of common sleep challenges, the field of sleep medicine has really focused on clinical sleep disorders, such as obstructive sleep apnea and insomnia, said Natasha Williams, an associate professor of population health who focuses on behavioral sleep medicine at New York University's School of Medicine. These medical conditions can be more clearly measured, diagnosed, and treated than everyday sleep issues. To be sure, there are also vast racial and socioeconomic disparities in the rates these serious conditions are diagnosed and treated. But this all-encompassing focus often overlooks the millions of people, a disproportionate number of whom are Black, who don't have a diagnosable sleep disorder, but whose chronic lack of restful sleep is putting them at higher risk for cardiometabolic disease and death. The fundamental cause of sleep inequities is structural racism. Another substantial challenge is disentangling sleep from all the other factors, such as diet, exercise, or weight, that can contribute to cardiovascular disease. A lot of adverse health behaviors are common bedfellows, Carnathan said. For example, experiencing poor sleep makes it less likely a person will exercise or eat healthfully, she said. And a lack of healthful eating or exercising can then lead back to poorer sleep, further propelling the harmful cycle. These feedback loops can further hasten cardiometabolic deterioration. For example, chronic poor sleep increases the odds of developing conditions including obesity, hypertension, and diabetes, all of which are more prevalent in Black populations. Each of those conditions then further increase the chances someone will have poorer sleep. Someone with diabetes, for example, might get up more often in the night because their high blood sugar can make people need to urinate more frequently. The cycle can exacerbate their existing conditions and put them at risk for new ones. Regardless of the contributing factors to poor sleep, from lifestyle to comorbidities, the fundamental cause of sleep inequities is structural racism, said Dana Johnson, an assistant professor of epidemiology who studies the origins of sleep health disparities and their impact on cardiovascular disease at Emory's University School of Public Health. Racism undercuts the opportunity for restorative sleep and cardiovascular health in numerous insidious ways. For one, researchers have long known that chronic stress diminishes sleep quality. Some proportion of sleep disparities are most certainly intertwined with psychological distress due to socioeconomic factors, interpersonal stress, racism, and discrimination, Carnathan said. Hale agreed, noting that, in order for one to sleep well, one needs to feel safe and not have a heightened sense of alertness that unfortunately many members of our society carry with them every day. That heightened vigilance, that fear of discrimination or maltreatment or distrust of your neighbors, is part of the reason why we believe we see racial and ethnic disparities in sleep. In general, people with higher socioeconomic status tend to get better sleep, but that restful benefit of rising fortunes does not track equally across races. Studies have shown that highly educated, high-income Black Americans still sleep more poorly than their white peers, taking longer to fall asleep and spending more time lying awake in bed. In fact, research has found that disparities in sleep are actually more vast between Black and white professionals as opposed to between Black and white blue-collar workers. One explanation for this pattern, according to some researchers, is that Black people at higher socioeconomic levels may find themselves more frequently in the minority at work or in their neighborhoods, increasing their daily experiences of racism and discrimination. Historic patterns of housing discrimination, which have created generations of wealth and environmental inequities, also impact sleep disparities. Redlining policies, which until the late 1960s legally prevented Black Americans from buying homes in certain areas, created neighborhoods with much poorer conditions for sleep, including higher levels of noise, light, poverty, and air pollution. I'll also add to that increased heat. I've reported on that a lot before. Decades of fallout from these racist policies have meant that scientifically validated sleep hygiene recommendations, such as quiet, dark, cool sleep environment, are often out of reach for those already most at risk for cardiovascular disease and death. For example, a person living in a low-income urban area without access to air conditioning might face multiple barriers to quality sleep. Opening windows could invite in excessive noise, light, and air pollution, while keeping windows closed could create a stifling environment. As temperature goes up, sleep quality goes down, Carnathan said. And as climate change makes nights even warmer, people living in city neighborhoods lacking green spaces, who are already disproportionately at risk for cardiovascular disease, face even more sleepless nights ahead. The environment and climate equity also play a role in sleep disparities. Those with lower household incomes, who, due to longstanding and structural social inequities, are more likely to be Black, are also more likely to face financial, food, and housing stressors, further pushing off restful sleep. And they are more likely to work multiple jobs, often involving shift work, which makes it harder to keep a regular sleep schedule. People living with more family members or are in higher density apartment buildings may also have less control over noise levels when they are trying to rest. This summer, in a Journal of Clinical Sleep Medicine, Johnson and two colleagues coined a new term for these pockets of sleep deprivation, sleep deserts. Like food deserts, these are geographical areas where quality sleep is more difficult to obtain, by no fault of the individuals living there. Johnson and others are hoping to spread the message that sleep poverty, like economic poverty, is not just individual behavior, she said. We have to consider the context in which people live. And ameliorating those deeply rooted forces behind health poverty is going to require substantial structural shifts. In the absence of a rapid reprieve from the insomnious impacts of structural racism, experts in the field of sleep and cardiovascular health suggest additional approaches that might help begin to reduce disparities in the meantime. It will be essential, for example, to ensure that recommendations for individuals are effective and practical for those who are trying to reach, Knutson said. It's not as simple as saying, hey, go out and sleep more, exercise better, eat better, Knutson said. There are only 24 hours a day, and there are a lot of competing priorities for individuals, getting a paycheck, paying the bills, and taking care of your kids. Those are going to take priority. Not everyone has the luxury and privilege of having sufficient time for sleep. The multidimensional nature of sleep, although tricky to study, also gives us more opportunity to think of a way to improve sleep that isn't just about quantity, Knutson said. Can we make it more regular or better quality? thinking about all the dimensions of sleep health, which we act upon to improve, that will be beneficial for their cardiovascular health. Knutson acknowledged that many people might realistically only have time for 5 or 6 hours of sleep. If that's the case, she suggested emphasizing sleep regularity, that is, ensuring that sleep happens at the same time each day. Hale added that this approach is especially important for people who work outside of standard business hours. Even if you must work shift work, work it in a way that you are not changing your shifts every single night, if possible. Knutson would also like to see more research focus on finding inexpensive, attainable ways to improve sleep that people will use and will work, she said. For example, that although earplugs sound like a reasonable solution for mitigating excess noise, many people don't feel safe wearing them while sleeping for fear they might not hear an intruder. As an alternative, she suggested dulling external sounds with white noise, which can come from a low-cost machine or free phone app and can be more finely controlled and feel less obstructive. Improving sleep with an aim of reducing cardiovascular disease disparities will also require larger improvements at home and in the community. In order for us to be truly effective in eliminating sleep inequities, we have to think about the broader context in which people live, Johnson said. As one illustration, she's involved with a program that helps people check and improve their home's insulation and ventilation, which can support sleep as well as reduce money spent on heating and cooling. Educating more physicians of color and more physicians generally around sleep could have an outsized positive impact in communities with a higher risk for heart disease, Johnson added. In a brief primary care visit, doctors often focus on immediately measurable, treatable clinical conditions, such as weight, high blood pressure, or diabetes, rather than sleep, even though sleep patterns often underlie the risk of these conditions. What will really move the needle on sleep equity for the long run, however, are changes to larger policies, experts said. That is what determines the neighborhood structure, including the amount of money that's allocated towards public health, Johnson said. Things like more robust rules around levels of air and noise pollution could help create healthier sleep environments, especially for communities already at highest risk for heart disease, but only if they are routinely and equitably enforced. Hale and her colleagues found that general investment in communities is associated with improvements in sleep health, even when those investments seem to have nothing at all to do with sleep itself. For example, in a 2021 sleep paper, they described how, over a 3-year period, individuals in a predominantly black and low-income Pittsburgh neighborhood who live close to new community assets, such as a new grocery store, park, or community center, showed improved sleep compared to those who live farther away from these investments. The idea is if you improve environments and communities, there will be a wide range of benefits for its residents, Hale said. Another seemingly unrelated policy has many sleep experts cautiously hopeful about the future. School districts around the country have been pushing back daily start times. Whether a high school student starts school at 7:30 a.m. or 8:30 a.m. might seem of little consequence for their risk for cardiovascular disease several decades later, but racial disparities in sleep begin before adulthood, and the risks for developing heart disease are cumulative across people's lifetimes. To the extent that cardiovascular health starts younger, we should be addressing these disparities in sleep as soon as possible. Research also shows later start times improve young people's overall health and learning, which could potentially contribute to shrinking socioeconomic disparities later. The challenge of all health education is getting people not only to listen, but to really internalize and hear what's being said, and then to change their behaviors, Hale said. But in many cases involving health disparities, when you have a structural condition that changes, then behavior change will follow, a rising tide to lift all ships. Other nationwide policies could help further reduce disparities in sleep and heart health. Johnson pointed to the positive health implications of passing a national livable minimum wage. If individuals could sustain their households on a single daytime job, they could have more time and less chronic stress for sleep. These policies at the federal level are what are really going to make a large impact on sleep and equity. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is Toledo's The People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, I want to switch gears and do two stories on medical debt, which continues to be the leading cause of bankruptcy in this country and a huge share of economic distress for people. First up from Kaiser Health News. Hundreds of hospitals sue patients or threaten their credit, a Kaiser Health News investigation finds. Does yours? Despite growing evidence of the harm caused by medical debt, hundreds of U.S. hospitals maintain policies to aggressively pursue patients for unpaid bills, using tactics such as lawsuits, selling patients' accounts to debt buyers, and reporting patients to credit rating agencies. The collection practices are commonplace among all types of hospitals in all regions of the country, including public university systems, leading academic institutions, small community hospitals, for-profit chains, and nonprofit Catholic systems. Individual hospital systems have come under scrutiny in recent years for suing patients, but the Kaiser Health News analysis shows that the practice is widespread, suggesting most of the nation's approximately 5,100 hospitals serving the general public had policies to use legal action or other aggressive tactics against patients. And although industry officials say they are careful about how they target patients for unpaid bills, few institutions have renounced what federal rules call, quote, extraordinary collection actions, even as medical debt forces millions of Americans to cut back on food and other essentials, drain retirement savings, and make other difficult sacrifices. At the same time, a majority of hospitals scrutinized by Kaiser Health News effectively shroud their collection activities, publicly posting incomplete or, in many cases, no information about what can happen to patients if they can't pay. These are among the findings of an examination of billing and financial aid at a diverse sample of 528 hospitals across the country. Over the past year, Kaiser Health News investigated each of these hospitals, reviewing thousands of pages of policies and other documents. The reporting also included thousands of telephone and email inquiries and interviews to obtain and clarify how hospitals handle patients with unpaid bills. Some hospitals did not respond to multiple requests for information, but Kaiser Health News was able to gather information about most. From them, a picture emerges of a minefield for patients where a trip to the hospital can not only produce jaw-dropping bills, but also expose patients to legal risks that jeopardize their livelihood. Among the findings, more than two-thirds of hospitals sue patients or take other legal actions against them, such as garnishing wages or placing liens on property. A similar share of hospitals report patients with outstanding bills to credit rating agencies, putting patients' credit scores and their ability to rent an apartment, buy a car, or get a job at risk. A quarter of hospitals sell patients' debts to debt collectors, who in turn can pursue patients for years for unpaid bills. About one in five hospitals deny non-emergency care for people with outstanding debt. Nearly 40% of all hospitals researched made no information available on their websites about their collection activities, although Kaiser Health News in some cases was able to obtain the information through repeated requests. People don't know what's going to happen to them. It can be terrifying, said Tracy Douglas, a consumer attorney at Bet Tedzik Legal Services in Los Angeles. Douglas described one older woman she worked with who was afraid to seek financial assistance from a hospital because she worried the hospital would seize her home if she couldn't pay. The impact of these collection practices can be devastating. Across the U.S. healthcare system, medical debt is taking a fearsome toll on patients, forcing more than half of adults with health-related debt to make difficult sacrifices, including taking on extra work, changing their living situation, or delaying their education, a Kaiser Family Foundation poll conducted for this project found. Charity care is offered at most U.S. hospitals, and nonprofit medical systems must provide financial aid as a condition of not paying taxes, a benefit that saves the industry billions of dollars annually. In many cases, patients who should qualify for assistance are instead targeted by bill collectors, whether by accident or by design. This is a long way from many of the so-called advanced industrial economies that have universal health care coverage, where getting a health care bill is actually unknown in many of these countries.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. the best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, next up, I have a story that's a little bit better news at trying to stave off the worst effects of our broken healthcare system. This in the New York Times, and it has a local angle. Good old Toledo's included in this. Medical debt is being erased in Ohio and Illinois. In the next few weeks, tens of thousands of people in Cook County, Illinois, will open their mailboxes to find a letter from the county government explaining that their medical debt has been paid off. Officials in New Orleans and Toledo, Ohio, are finalizing contracts so that tens of thousands of residents can receive a similar letter in the coming year. In Pittsburgh on December 19th, the city council approved a budget that would include $1 million for medical debt relief. More local governments are likely to follow as county executives and city councils embrace a new strategy to address the high cost of health care. They are partnering with RIP Medical Debt, a nonprofit that aims to abolish medical debt by buying it from hospitals, health systems, and collection agencies at a steep discount. What we need in this country is universal health care, clearly. Tony Preckwinkle, the president of the Board of Commissioners of Cook County, said, but we're not there as a nation yet. And so those of us who are responsible for local units of government have to do everything we can to make healthcare available, accessible to all. About 18% of Americans have medical debt that have been turned over to a third party for collection, according to a report published in July 2021 in the medical journal JAMA. That figure does not account for medical debt that is carried on credit cards or all medical bills owed for providers. Research shows that people with medical debt are less likely to seek needed care, and that medical debt can damage people's credit and make it even more difficult for them to secure employment. Cook County plans to spend $12 million on medical debt relief and expects to erase debt for the first batch of beneficiaries by early January. In Lucas County, Ohio, and its largest city, Toledo, up to $240 million in medical debt could be paid off at a cost of $1.6 million. Now, just take a gander at that. So this gives you an idea of what the debt industry is. So you've got debt collectors that are trying to collect $240 million. The fact that you could actually settle that debt, what it's actually worth trying to get blood out of a turnip, that you would settle for less than 1%, $1.6 million, shows that this industry is morally bankrupt. Okay, on with the story. New Orleans is looking to spend $1.3 million to clear $130 million in medical debt. The $1 million in Pittsburgh's budget could wipe out $115 million in debt, officials said. These initiatives are all being funded by President Biden's trillion-dollar American Rescue Plan, which infused local governments with cash to spend on infrastructure, public services, and economic relief programs. Health policy experts say that while medical debt relief provides an immediate benefit to people, it does not address the root causes of medical debt, which is almost non-existent outside the United States. To be eligible for debt relief through the RIP medical debt, people must have a household income up to 400% of the federal poverty level, or about $111,000 for a family of four, or have medical debts that exceed 5% of their annual income. People cannot apply to be considered for debt relief, and they do not pay taxes on the purchase of their debt. RIP medical debt analyzes debt portfolios to determine who qualifies. Wendy Pestrew, the chief executive of the United Way of Greater Toledo, said debt relief could remove a source of economic stress for the 43% of families who either were living in poverty or were unable to afford housing, childcare, food, transportation, or health care in Toledo, which is a population of nearly 269,000. It puts some of this economic strength back in the hands of those who are having debt exonerated and really helps them plan for their stability, she said. Michelle Grimm, who joined the Toledo City Council in January 2022, pushed for some of the city's $180 million in the American Rescue Plan funds to be used for medical debt relief after she read about the Cook County initiative. Here's something so simple that local governments can do, maybe even state governments can do, to really help ease the burden on people, because we really need an overhaul in our system, and that's going to take years, said Ms. Grimm, who is leaving the council at the end of the year because she was elected in November to be a Democratic state representative. Toledo City Council voted 7-5 on November 9th to provide $800,000 to pay off the debt. Its contribution was matched by Lucas County, resulting in $1.6 million for medical debt relief. The city, the county, and RIP Medical Debt are now working out a contract. Medical debt relief appears to be popular. A poll by Tolchin Research found that 71% of respondents supported it, 50% supported relieving student debt, 65% supported Medicare for All, and 68% supported expanding Medicaid. The national poll of 1,500 people was conducted online from November 14th to the 20th after the Toledo vote and had a margin of sampling area of plus or minus 3 percentage points. Ms. Grimm's husband did work for the polling company. This debt relief comes as states change how medical debt is treated. In November, Governor Kathy Hochul of New York signed legislation that blocked healthcare providers from using property liens or garnishing wages to collect medical debt. The day before the Toledo City Council vote, 72% of Arizona voters chose to lower interest rates for medical debt and to increase protections for people who owe debt, though a judge has since halted part of the measure. Wesley Yin, an associate professor of economics at the University of California, LA, said medical debt relief could be a game changer for some people, but government should also be addressing the causes of medical debt, including high costs and limited access to good health insurance. In partnership with RIP Medical Debt, Professor Yin is studying how the group's work affects people's livelihoods. I believe there are some positive effects economically, but it might be more muted compared to the face value of the debt that is being forgiven, he said. Daniel Skinner, a health policy professor at Ohio University in Athens, said that debt relief was low-hanging fruit, considering that the mean amount of medical debt people carry is in the hundreds, not tens of thousands of dollars. We need to get the cost of medicine under control, ultimately, Professor Skinner said. I'm all for what Toledo is doing. I'm all for what Cook County and now New Orleans are doing. But ultimately, we can't get back every couple of years and do this. It's not good policy. It's not efficient. Supporters of debt relief measure agree that there's more to be done. RIP Medical Debt's chief executive, Allison Saiso, said that a key part of the group's work was to further discussions about changing the healthcare system. In the past 2 years, RIP Medical Debt has placed more of an emphasis on buying direct debt directly from hospitals and health systems before it reaches collectors. Ms. Saiso said that this gave the group a direct channel to talk with hospitals about how their own health repayment plans for low-income patients work. Some of these people whose debt RIP Medical Debt buys should have qualified for these programs in the first place, but they were not enrolled, she said. I do this job every day, and I appreciate that what we're doing is really important and helpful for the individual, and we are helping, and it is resolving the problem for them, Ms. Saiso said. At the same time, I can't help but wonder and question why my existence as an institution is needed in the first place. Yep, when people are put through the meat grinder, sometimes a little hard to put them back, but hey, definitely can help break the cycle a bit, interrupt it. Good news, Toledo and others. Keep it up.
And now for a word from our lack of sponsors. PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal health care. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
Okay, next up from Associated Press. U.S. starts grappling with, quote, travesty of untreated hepatitis C. Too many Americans are missing out on a cure for hepatitis C, and a study underway in a hard-hit corner of Kentucky is exploring a simple way to start changing that. The key? On-the-spot diagnosis to replace today's multiple-step testing. In about an hour with just a finger prick of blood, researchers can tell some of the toughest-to-treat patients, that is, people who inject drugs, they have hepatitis C and hand over potentially life-saving medication. Waiting for standard tests even 1 or 2 days for someone who's actively using drugs, we can lose touch with them, said Jennifer Havens of the University of Kentucky, who's leading the study. To start treatment right away, that's huge, absolutely huge. Single-visit hepatitis C diagnosis already is offered in other countries, and now the White House wants to make it a priority here. It's frankly an embarrassment that the U.S. doesn't have such an option, said Jeffrey Weiss of New York's Mount Sinai Health System, who works with a community hepatitis C outreach program. We have many people we've tested and want to give their results to and can't find them. At least 2.4 million Americans are estimated to have hepatitis C, a virus that silently attacks the liver, leading to cancer or the need for an organ transplant. It leads to more than 14,000 deaths a year. That's even though a daily pill taken for 2 or 3 months could cure nearly everyone with few side effects. Yet in the U.S., more than 40% of people with hepatitis C don't even know they're infected. Fewer than 1 in 3 insured patients who are diagnosed go on to get timely treatment. And new infections are surging among younger adults who share drug needles. This is a travesty, said Dr. Francis Collins, the former NIH director, who is now a White House advisor devising a new national strategy to tackle hepatitis C. Most likely to fall through the cracks are people in tough times, those who inject drugs, are uninsured or on Medicaid, or are homeless or incarcerated, who can't navigate what Collins calls the clunky diagnosis process and other barriers to the pricey pills. For the country not to address those inequities feels like a moral failing, Collins told the Associated Press. All American adults are urged to be screened for hepatitis C, a blood test that simply tells if someone's been exposed. Because the immune system sometimes clears the virus, anyone found positive must get a different kind of blood test to confirm they're still infected. If so, they return again to be prescribed treatment. But in Britain, Australia, and parts of Europe, people can get on-the-spot hepatitis C diagnostic testing using a machine made by California-based Cepheid, Inc. It's sort of a lab in a box that's especially useful for mobile clinics and needle exchange programs, where hard-to-reach populations can be tested and start treatment on a single visit. This kind of technology isn't new. Cepheid's version already is used in the U.S. to do quick tests for COVID-19, flu, and certain bacterial infections, among other things. But test manufacturers haven't gone through the complex U.S. regulatory process for approval to diagnose hepatitis C. Chief Scientific Officer David Persing said Cepheid hopes to take the steps next year using a new pandemic-era program that would streamline the evidence needed for clearance of an easy-access test and treat option. Testing isn't the only hurdle. A full course of hepatitis C pills costs about $24,000, much less than when they first hit the market, but enough that many states still restrict which Medicaid patients are treated. Some require proof of sobriety to get care, stalling efforts to stop current spread of the virus among people who inject drugs. Others add red tape, prior authorization requirements, and some order consultations with liver specialists, according to the National Viral Hepatitis Roundtable and Harvard researchers. Pilot programs have attempted to overcome such barriers. For example, Louisiana negotiated a yearly flat fee for unlimited doses of hepatitis C medication for Medicaid patients and state prisoners. It got off to a strong start, but was interrupted by the COVID-19 pandemic and hasn't recovered. Louisiana has treated about 12,600 such patients since 2019, out of an estimated 40,000 in need. The scope of Collins' plans for a national hepatitis program will depend on how much funding the Biden administration comes up with, but faster, easier testing is a priority. In Perry County, Kentucky, Havens' team uses a Cepheid test in an NIH-funded study on how to improve the care for hepatitis C patients struggling with addiction. While potential study participants await their test results, researchers teach them about the virus and offer other health services. Even if they test negative, they still got something useful from the visit, Havens said. Okay, and another story getting at the healthcare system's ability to treat, in this case, a much more common widespread issue, this from Medical Express. Glycemic control stagnant in U.S. from 1988 to 2020. The researchers found that the proportion of patients with diabetes who received insulin and achieved glycemic control did not change significantly from the period of 1988 to 1994 to 2013 to 2020. With only improving from 29% to 28%. Compared with non-Hispanic white adults, Mexican-American adults who received insulin were less likely to achieve glycemic control. Disparities actually increase. There were no significant changes observed in proportion of adults with severe hyperglycemia, which was 15% in 2013 to 2020. The highest prevalence of severe hyperglycemia was seen in adults who were Mexican-American or non-Hispanic black, uninsured, or had low family income. Despite advancements in insulin formulations and diabetes management strategies, glycemic control and severe hyperglycemia among adults using insulin did not improve in the general U.S. adult population with diabetes, the authors wrote. Okay, well, I want to close on a story that fits in the category of better late than never, or perhaps you can always rely on government doing the right thing, but only after exhausting every other possibility. This from Veterans of America News. U.S. pays to clean up Agent Orange on Vietnam War anniversary. The United States announced a contract worth up to $29 million to clean up dioxin contamination in the Binh Hoa Air Base in southern Vietnam near Ho Chi Minh City, a consequence of U.S. use of the herbicide Agent Orange during the Vietnam War. The move is the most recent attempt to demonstrate cooperation between the two countries despite a still complicated relationship. The nations now work together on trade issues, climate change, and legacies of the war, such as the dioxin spraying or the so-called Christmas bombings. 50 years ago this month, when Americans dropped 20,000 tons of bombs on Hanoi and Haiphong. This announcement represents the United States' commitment to our partnership with Vietnam. Alera Grubbs, the Hanoi-based Vietnam mission director for the USAID, said, "This contract will complete critical preparatory work, paving the way for the treatment phase of the project." Both the U.S. and Vietnamese governments are participating in the entire cleanup across the country, which is estimated to require more than 10 years at a cost of approximately $450 million. Washington said it expects to spend $300 million in the end and has allocated more than $163 million so far. Yep, the long-term consequences of war. Okay, well, let's get to the segment entitled Bonus Articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all of the stories I reported on in this episode. I'll give you the link at the end of the list. 18 bonus articles this week. First up, how Central Ohio got people to reduce their food waste. Well, in the U.S., about one-third of food is wasted. And Upper Arlington, north of Columbus, had a program that helped reduce this. Bonus article two, three things to watch in chronic disease in 2023. Obesity drugs, long COVID, and healthcare costs. Obesity drugs have shown to be very effective, but they're very expensive. How that plays out will be an interesting thing to see. Long COVID is still just starting long-term studies on how to identify, classify, and treat. And healthcare costs have been as high for individuals with premiums, copays, and out-of-pocket expenses as they've ever been. Bonus article three, No Surprises Act implementation is full of surprises. So the No Surprises Act was the one that was supposed to get rid of surprise bills. Well, as it turns out, with a bunch of litigation and stopgap measures that people, basically healthcare companies, have been trying to do workarounds, it turns out that trying to regulate healthcare is pretty much like trying to get rich people to pay taxes. They're very slippery. Bonus article four, classifying aging as a disease could speed FDA drug approvals. This is one of the most cleverly evil stories I think I've seen in a little while, at least this week. So the idea, okay, the FDA requires for a drug approval that you actually have a condition, you know, whether it's diabetes or hepatitis C or whatever it is, you need a condition to actually treat. So drug companies actually want to consider aging a disease. So in other words, if you're not dead, meaning you're continuing to age, they want to be able to sell you a drug. Now, they've already got, you know, 10% or more of the population on antipsychotics and antidepressant drugs, and you've got, you know, 20% or so of the population on statins, you know, but this isn't enough. They want to, I'm sure if they bring this stuff to bear, you'll probably end up having 40% of the population taking some so-called anti-aging drug, which probably doesn't really work or is not cost-effective, considering that they'll probably have something that's relatively expensive. Of course, raising healthcare costs for all. Okay. Article 5. High number of mosquitoes found with mutation that resists insecticides. So this was in Southeast Asia. There was an overwhelming majority of the mosquitoes that were tested actually were shown to be resistant to the most common insecticides. This is something that's likely to spread and is kind of a proof of concept type of thing. That is something probably coming down the pike. And this means that vector-borne illnesses, mosquito-transmitted things like malaria and chikungunya and Zika and the whole bunch, a whole array of things that mostly the third world has to deal with, are going to be stymied if this it turns out that you can't kill them off with insecticides. Okay, Article 6, study finds lack of racial ethnic inclusivity in OB-GYN research. Not a surprise. And drilling down beyond the research level to the clinical level, Article 6, she says doctors ignored her concerns about her pregnancy. For many black women, it's a familiar story. And third, in this triumvirate, Article 8, racist doctors and organ thieves. Why so many black people distrust the healthcare system. If you're curious, just listen to the show for a while and you'll have plenty of reason to talk a lot about racial disparities. Article 9, University of California, San Francisco apologizes for experiments done on prisoners in the 60s and 70s. Did a bunch of unethical experiments and now they're apologizing. Also falling under the better late than never, but it looks like 50 years or more seems to be the time frame when apologies seem to be possible to make. Article 10. It's been a tough year for transgender medicine. So transgender folks have had to put up with a lot of threat and violence increasing in recent years, and those in transgender medicine have had to put up with a lot of crap as well. Article 11, can politics kill you? Research says the answer increasingly is yes. Now, of course, the politics of like anti-trans stuff is definitely dangerous. But what this article is really talking about is what I've reported on before. And there's even a new article that expands upon this, that basically those in red states versus blue states or red counties versus blue counties, because the policies are so different, that the conservative counties, actually the sum total of their policies is not good for public health, population health, meaning that people are more likely to get sick and die. And then that divide seems to be getting larger and larger. Now, there's one issue that I wish the conservative right-wingers would get more on, and that's Article 12 here. In child welfare cases, most of your constitutional rights don't apply. There's a lot of talk about, you know, parental rights and stuff, but I don't hear the right talking about a lot about protecting parents' rights. And just the most basic constitutional rights. When a child welfare case is investigated, it's treated much like a criminal investigation rather than a civil investigation, and a lot of rights are thrown to the wind. Okay, Article 13, the bittersweet defeat of MPOX. The epidemic has largely subsided, but largely because queer men seem to have learned more from AIDS and COVID-19 than the authorities did. So it's a success of communities taking care of themselves, but public health as a whole didn't really do that great of a job. Article 14, under new rules, methadone clinics can offer more take-at-home doses. Will they? Well, it looks like most methadone clinics are not taking advantage of the relaxed rules, even though they've been shown to be as safe and effective, partly because there's a industrial complex of treatment that have done things for a long ways and they don't want to change. Article 15, psychotherapy, less expensive and better than pills. It's what the patients want, but don't get. Good read. Article 16, major effort needed at FDA to remove illegal vaping products review fines. So the FDA had an extensive review, and they've not been able to keep up with the thousands of new vaping products. Another tobacco-related story, 17, tobacco. Vaping and smoking drive environmental harm from farm to fingertips. So one more reason to oppose tobacco and vaping and doing prevention work on that. And if you yourself are a smoker or know somebody who's a smoker, Article 18, resolve to be smoke-free in 23. Resources and tips to help. You can always call 1-800-QUIT-NOW to get access to resources as well. You can read these and other stories on toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some drugs.